In the next edition, he ran a sweet little story with a photo of me announcing my internship at the Times. It made the front page. News was slow in those days. The announcement contained two horrendous errors that would haunt me for years. The first and less serious was the fact that Syracuse had now joined the Ivy League, at least according to Spot. He informed his dwindling readership that I had received my Ivy League education at Syracuse. It was a month before anyone mentioned this to me. I was beginning to believe that no one read the paper, or worse, those who did were complete idiots. The second misstatement changed my life. I was born Joyner William Traynor. Until I was 12, I hammered my parents with inquiries about why two supposedly intelligent people would stick Joyner on a newborn. The story finally leaked that one of my parents, both of whom denied responsibility, had insisted on Joyner as an olive branch to some feuding relative who allegedly had money. I never met the man, my namesake. He died broke as far as I was concerned, but I nonetheless had Joyner for a lifetime. When I enrolled at Syracuse, I was J. William, a rather imposing name for an 18-year-old. But Vietnam and the riots and all the rebellion and social upheaval convinced me that J. William sounded too corporate, too establishment. I became Will. Spot at various times called me Will, William, Bill, or even Billy, and since I would answer to all of them, I never knew what was next. In the announcement under my smiling face was my new name, Willie Traynor. I was horrified. I had never dreamed of anyone calling me Willie. I went to a prep school in Memphis and then to college in New York, and I had never met a person named Willie. I wasn't a good old boy. I drove a Triumph Spitfire and had long hair. What would I tell my fraternity brothers at Syracuse? What would I tell BB? After hiding in my apartment for 2 days, I mustered the courage to confront Spot and demand he do something. I wasn't sure what, but he'd made the mistake and he could damn well fix it. I marched into the Times office and bumped into Davey Big Mouth Bass, the sports editor of the paper.
"Hey, cool name," he said.
I followed him into his office seeking advice. "My name's not Willie," I said.
"It is now."
"My name's Will."
"They'll love you around here. A smart ass from up north with long hair and a little imported sports car. Hell, folks will think you're pretty cool with a name like Willie. Think of Joe Willie."
"Who's Joe Willie?"
"Joe Willie Namath."
"Oh, him."
"Yeah, he's a Yankee like you, from Pennsylvania or someplace. But when he got to Alabama, he went from Joseph William to Joe Willie. The girls chased him all over the place."
I began to feel better. In 1970, Joe Namath was probably the most famous athlete in the country. I went for a drive and kept repeating, "Willie." Within a couple of weeks, the name was beginning to stick. Everybody called me Willie and seemed to feel more comfortable because I had such a down-to-earth name. I told BB it was just a temporary pseudonym. The Times was a very thin paper, and I knew immediately that it was in trouble. Heavy on the obits, light on news and advertising. The employees were disgruntled, but quiet and loyal. Jobs were scarce in Ford County in 1970. After a week, it was obvious, even to my novice eyes, that the paper was operating at a loss. Obits are free. Ads are not. Spot spent most of his time in his cluttered office napping periodically and calling the funeral home. Sometimes they called him. Sometimes the families would stop just hours after Uncle Wilbur's last breath and hand over a long, flowery, handwritten narrative that Spot would seize and carry delicately to his desk. Behind a locked door, he would write, edit, research, and rewrite until it was perfect. He told me the entire county was mine to cover. The paper had one other general reporter, Baggy Suggs, a pickled old goat who spent his hours hanging around the courthouse across the street, sniffing for gossip and drinking bourbon with a small club of washed-up lawyers, too old and too drunk to practice anymore. As I would soon learn, Baggy was too lazy to check sources and dig for anything interesting, and it was not unusual for his front-page story to be some dull account of a boundary dispute or a wife beating. Margaret, the secretary, was a fine Christian lady who ran the place, though she was smart enough to allow Spot to think he was the boss. She was in her early 50s and had worked there for 20 years. She was the rock, the anchor, and everything at the Times revolved around her. Margaret was soft-spoken, almost shy, and from day one was completely intimidated by me because I was from Memphis and had gone to school up north for 5 years. I was careful not to wear my Ivy League-ness on my shoulder, but at the same time I wanted these rural Mississippians to know that I had been superbly educated. She and I became gossiping pals, and after a week she confirmed what I already suspected, that Mr. Caudle was indeed crazy, and that the newspaper was indeed in dire financial straits. But she said the Caudles have family money. It would be years before I understood this mystery. In Mississippi, family money was not to be confused with wealth. It had nothing to do with cash or other assets. Family money was a status obtained by someone who was white, somewhat educated beyond high school, born in a large home with a front porch, preferably one surrounded by cotton or soybean fields, although this was not mandatory, and partially reared by a beloved black maid named Bessie or Pearl, partially reared by doting grandparents who once owned the ancestors of Bessie or Pearl, and lectured from birth on the stringent social graces of a privileged people. Acreage and trust funds helped somewhat, but Mississippi was full of insolvent blue bloods who inherited the status of family money. It could not be earned. It had to be handed down at birth.